the 21st study of the Book of Revelation, held at the Enfield Ecclesial Hall on the 6th of April 1976. Brother John Knowles speaking to the subject, The Seven Trumpets, God's Judgment on Catholic Rome. And the reading chosen is from Revelation chapter 8.
Hymn 198. Reading for our consideration and our class tonight is Revelation chapter 8, eighth chapter of the book of the Revelation, and we'll read that together with Brother Peter Halpin. Revelation chapter 8.
Reading together from the Word of God, Revelation chapter 8. And when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. And another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense, that he should offer it with the prayers of all saints upon the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand. And the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it into the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. And the seven angels which had the seven trumpets prepared themselves to sound. The first angel sounded, and there followed hail and fire mingled with blood, and they were cast upon the earth. And the third part of trees was burnt up, and all green grass was burnt up. And the second angel sounded, and as it were a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood. And the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed. And the third angel sounded, and there fell a great star from heaven, burning as it were a lamp. And it fell upon the third part of the rivers and upon the fountains of waters. And the name of the star is called Wormwood. And the third part of the waters became wormwood. And many men died of the waters because they were made bitter. And the fourth angel sounded, and the third part of the sun was smitten, and the third part of the moon, and the third part of the stars. So as the third part of them was darkened, and the day shone not for a third part of it, and the night likewise. And I beheld, and heard an angel flying through the midst of heaven, saying with a loud voice, Woe, woe, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpets of the three angels which are yet to sound.
The subject which Brother John is going to consider tonight is the seven trumpets, God's judgments on Catholic Rome. Brother John.
Dear class members, we've come to this section now where we're going to commence Revelation chapter 8. When we did Revelation chapter 7 verse 1, we read there that after these things I saw four angels standing on the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, nor on the sea, nor on any tree. And I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels, to whom it was given to hurt the earth and the sea, saying, Hurt not the earth, neither the sea, nor the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God in their foreheads. And then the rest of that chapter deals with the sealing of the servants of God, and then of the vision of this great multitude which no man could number. And so it appears now as we come into chapter 8, that the theme is now harking back to these four angels which were able to allow the wind to blow, but which were restrained from doing so until the subsequent events of chapter 7 were fulfilled. So we can say then, as Brother Thomas suggests, that the trumpets in chapter 8, and particularly the first four, which he calls the four wind trumpets, are in fact the counterpart to the work of chapter 7 verses 1 to 3, where these angels were restrained from blowing, but they commenced their blowing in chapter 8. Now that's generally the picture where we are, but we may have to go back for one or two to once again get an overall picture of the structure of the book as far as these trumpets and vials and so forth are concerned. So just to hark back to the transparency which we've seen once before, as far as the historical section of the book is concerned, we're looking at three main divisions: the seals, the trumpets, and the vials. The seals were God's judgments on pagan Rome from AD 96 through to AD 324. And we may recall, therefore, that chapter 6, which was the last of the historical sections that we were looking at, ended around about 324 AD, with the fall of pagan Rome and the rise of so-called Christian Rome, or what we are going to style Catholic Rome in the sense of it being universal. So this chapter that we're looking at this evening brings us to the commencement of God's judgments on Catholic Rome, and that is the seven trumpets. Chapter 8 deals with the first four of these, and then the subsequent ones are dealt with in later chapters. So this is the period of history we're looking at. This evening we're going to be looking at events from 324 AD for around about 100 years after that. They are the early trumpets. And we're going to see how that God was now to judge this new system. Whilst the pagan system had ostensibly passed away, it had been replaced by something which was called Christian. But it didn't bear any more relationship to true Christianity than did pagan Rome. All it had done was that it changed the names of the pagan gods to some of the names associated with Christianity. But it was still very much pagan, and it was to be judged. And so we're going to look then, first of all, at these opening verses in chapter 8. We're told in chapter 8 and verse 1 that when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven about the space of half an hour. Now let's have a look at this symbol first of all, the one which is the space of about half an hour. We've mentioned from time to time about the significance of the day for a year principle. I wonder at times whether we take a little bit too much for granted and whether perhaps a lot of people aren't aware of the significance of this. This is a somewhat intricate verse as far as this day for a year principle is concerned. So let's go back to the beginning and establish the usage in the Bible of this day for a year principle. On our transparency, which we're projecting up here at the moment, we've got the heading that the Bible frequently uses the principle of a day for a year. And we've listed three examples. Let's look at each one of these in turn to see the way in which this day for a year principle is used in the Bible. Now, in Numbers chapter 14 and verse 34, we have one example of this. Numbers chapter 14 and verse 34. After the number of the days in which ye searched the land, even 40 days, each day for a year shall ye bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and ye shall know my breach of promise. So, he says, after the number of the days that you searched the land, that is 40 days, I'm going to make you wander 40 years. And so God makes the punishment commensurate with their sin. But he multiplies it on the basis of a day for a year. For every day of the of their faithlessness in spying out the land, he would make them wander for a year. We come to our second one, which is a similar example, in Ezekiel chapter 4 and verse 4. But this one is just a little more complex. Don't mean complex in the sense of difficult, but it is more than just a simple statement that 40 days will equal 40 years. In Ezekiel chapter 4, Ezekiel is told that he is to deliver this sign unto the people of Israel. And he's told in verse 4 that he is to lie upon his left side and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it, according to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity. For I have laid upon thee the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shalt thou bear the iniquity of the house of Israel. And when thou hast accomplished them, lie again on thy right side, and thou shalt bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have appointed thee each day for a year. And so he was told to lie on one side for 390 days and on the other side for 40 days. 390 plus 40 makes a total of 430 years. And if you've got the section in the back of the old edition of Elpis Israel accessible to you, known as Chronicon Hebraicon, there's quite a detailed exposition of that there by Brother Thomas, in which he shows that prior to the time of Ezekiel, there had been 430 years of transgression. He says, in fact, the house of Israel and the house of Judah had been great transgressors of the Holy Covenant from the foundation of the temple in the fourth year of Solomon to the sack of the city in the 19th year of Nebuchadnezzar. This was a period of 430 years, dating from B.C. 1022 to B.C. 592. It was divided into two parts, namely one of 40 years from the foundation of the temple to the apostasy of Rehoboam and Judah, to the other of 390 years from this apostasy to the destruction of the temple. God determined that this long national transgression should be punished by as long a retribution. So he therefore gave Israel a sign of what was coming upon them, and this consisted in Ezekiel lying on his side for so many days, and God would bring the punishment for so many years. And the other reference that we have there is Daniel chapter 8 and at verse 14. Daniel chapter 8 verse 14 speaks of the 2,300 days in answer to the question, how long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And the answer in verse 14 is, unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. And we are living at the end of that period in years. We believe that this dates from the battle of Granicus, that very important battle when Alexander the Great invaded the area of Persia and defeated the Persians, and it ends in the period 1966-1967, dating therefore from BC 334-333 through to 1966-1967, which is 2,300 years, answering to the symbolical period of 2,300 days. So those are three examples of the way in which the scripture uses the day for a year principle. And we come across it two or three times in Revelation as well. Well, going back then to Revelation, we find that what happens here, as I said, is a little more involved than these fairly simple ones. And I'm using the word simple not in the sense as being opposite to difficult, but being as opposed to, say, complex. Because we're now looking at the use of this time period broken down into the hours of a day. So rather than particularly multiplying days, and we say that 430 days equals 430 years, or 2,300 days equals 2,300 years, let's come back the other way and break the day down into hours, which is what is happening here. And so the explanation which we've got on the transparency before us now tells us that there is a similar use of the principle found in Revelation chapter 8 and verse 1. Now in Revelation chapter 8 and verse 1 it says that when he opened the seventh seal, silence ensued in the heaven about half an hour. About half an hour. So it's an indefinite time, it's about half an hour. But let's find out what we mean by half an hour. Well, if one day equals 1 year, we can say, therefore, that one day equals 360 days. Now, there are actually, in fact, 360, not 365 and a quarter, days in the Jewish year. You say, well, what do they do with the other 5 and a quarter days? Well, every now and again they put in an extra month, which balances up the difference. They put in the month the Adar every few years, and that balances up the difference. So they have 13 months some years. That therefore gives them this nice, very significant figure of 360, which is divisible equally by 12 and 30 and numbers like that. So the Jewish year is 360 days. So on the basis of one day for a year, we say that one day can equal 360 days, or, as it is in this particular place, one day equals 360 years. On the basis of a day for a year. So it's a double application of this principle of the day for a year. One day equals 1 year, that is one day equals 360 days, or one day equals 360 years. Have you absorbed that? Well, we'll go on to the next stage. But one day is made up of 12 hours. You might think it's 24, but it's not. It's really 12 hours as it's used in the Bible. The word hour, the Greek word ora, is defined as the 12th part of a day in the Greek language, according to Vine's Expository Dictionary. One day is made up of 12 hours. So if one day is made up of 12 hours, we can say, therefore, that 1 hour, which is the 12th part of a day, will be 360 divided by 12. Alright? If one day equals 360 years, and 1 hour is the 12th part of one of these days, well, it's going to be the 12th part of 360. That's 1 hour. But the passage here says about half an hour. So half an hour will be half that again. So if we take 360, divide it by 12, and divide it by 2, it gives us an answer of 15 years. 15 day years, if you like. Now the fact is that Revelation chapter 8 verse 1 says it was about half an hour. And historically, the events which are herein foreshadowed took place between the years AD 324 and 337. which was a period of 14 years, which is about 15 years. It was about 15 years. It was between 14 and 15 years. It wasn't exactly, it was about it. So that's what is meant when we find the statement that it was about half an hour. Now, I don't know how quickly you absorbed that. I didn't absorb it all that quickly when I was trying to study it, and I've set it out in this fashion because I think maybe that's a little easier than what's in the notes. The notes are very similar to what's in Eureka, but perhaps if we set it out on this fashion, you can take it down and take it away and think about it. So for those who haven't done mathematics for a few years, let's just go through it again and give yourself a test when you get home and see if you can remember how you worked it out. I tried that one or two times and I found I couldn't remember. So now that I've written down in this fashion, I think if you asked me tomorrow to explain it again without the transparency, I'd get it fairly right. How I'd go in a week's time, I don't know. So it's one of those little quirks of Bible numerology. Let's look at it again. We take a day to represent a year. Therefore, a day can be said to represent 360 days because there's 360 days in a year. Therefore, making this a day for a year principle, one day equals 360 years. But we're looking for an hour, and an hour is the 12th part of a day. Therefore, if there's 360 years in a day, there are 360 divided by 12 hours in a day. And a half an hour will therefore be 360 divided by 12 and divided by 2 again to halve that. And that makes 15. So 15 years would be half an hour, and between 14 and 15 years is, as Revelation chapter 8 verse 1 says, about half an hour. Now, if you happen to have your notes open on page 88, you'll find something very similar said there, and we go on to say what it was that happened in this about half an hour period. The first paragraph of our notes on page 88 tells us that peace in the ruling realm is here foreshadowed as the result of Constantine's triumph over paganism. This interval of peace, which is described there by that term silence, this period of peace lasted close on 15 years and is indicated in apocalyptic symbology as about half an hour. So we go on to say that if 15 years equals half an hour, then 30 years would be 1 hour, and 12 hours or one day would equal 360 years. Now, I didn't think that explained it very well, so that's why we've set it out in this other fashion. 360 days was the length of the ordinary ancient year, and as a day was prophetically used to represent one such ordinary year, we have here one such year treated as a day by the clock, but each day of it taken to represent a year. And I reckon that sounded a bit of a conundrum, so I hope you can understand it a little bit better with the aid of that transparency. The record states about half an hour, that is about 15 years. The actual period was 14 years, dating from 324 AD until 337. And you remember that's the point where we last left off of when we were looking at the seals, the time of Constantine. Now, our note goes on to say that whilst there was silence in the government, that is in the heaven, there was uproar in the church, in inverted commas, characterized by every evil work, which at length became the cause of the providentially retributive voices and thunders and lightnings and earthquakes which preceded the preparation of the angels to whom the sounding of the seven trumpets was assigned. So what actually happened was this, that there was providentially provided a period of peace, a period of about 15 years. And whilst there was peace in the ruling heavens, there wasn't so in what is styled the church. But this brings us on, therefore, to the next few verses, which we've blocked together here as verses 2 to 5. Verses 2 to 5 tell us that John then saw seven angels who stood in the sight of the deity, and seven trumpets had been given to them, and another angel came and stood by the altar having a golden censer, and there was given to him many odours that he might cast for the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which is in the sight of the throne. And the smoke of the perfumes for the prayers of the saints ascended from the hand of the angel in the presence of the deity. And the angel took the censer and filled it from the fire of the altar and cast it into the earth, and there were voices and thunders and lightnings and an earthquake. Now this is one of those very important statements which shows to us the real meaning of the apocalypse. The altar of incense here represents the prayers of the saints. We are not just reading a history book. We are having presented to us a picture of the way in which God acts in the earth. And he is acting here because of the prayers of the saints. Now we can study this and say, oh yeah, that's all very well, I believe that too. But do we see the counterpart in our own day? Do we pray as avidly as these people that God's purpose might be fulfilled, that Babylon the Great today might come down? Do you know, I think that sometimes we feel that God's purpose has been worked out in a very mechanical fashion, that we say, well, he knows when it's all going to happen, what's the use of me praying for it? And whilst we pray that Christ's coming might come, and some might say, hasten the day, and all this sort of thing, I think in the back of a lot of minds there is the feeling, well, you know, I wonder if I really should be praying for that, because God has set down the day and the hour. And yet time after time in the apocalypse, we have the statement made that these things happened because of the prayers of the saints. Now I'm not necessarily going to say that the prayers of the saints alter the time factor. I don't think they particularly alter the time factor. But in from God's viewpoint, he is acting because of these people. He is intervening in the affairs of the earth because these people want it. If they don't bother to pray for it, he'll still intervene, but instead of them being saved out of it, well, they'll just be absorbed in the general judgments which are taking place. So here's a group of people who could see what was going on. They prayed that God's glory might be revealed in the earth. Not necessarily that things might happen quicker than what he has planned, and not so much for the fact either that their miserable flesh and bones might be saved, but rather they are desirous of seeing this apostasy wiped out of the earth, and they are praying that it might go. They are God-centered people. They are interested in God's glory being manifest, and that's what the apocalypse is all about. And so it's all very well to know that this silence lasted for about half an hour, and we can expound all about a day for a year principle. But it's during this period that the saints, the true believers, are praying for the glory of God to come. They are really concerned with it. And as they study their Bibles, their whole concern is that it might shortly be fulfilled. How do we feel in this respect today? Well, that's a question we've got to answer ourselves, as to whether we do really see the need to pray that God's glory might be revealed in order that we might be part and parcel of it. Now these are the things we've got to see as we study the book of Revelation. And here in verse 2 then, John sees the seven angels who stood in the sight of the deity with the seven trumpets which had been given to them. And the whole thing is associated with judgments that are to be poured out on the earth, and it's going to be in answer to the prayers of the saints. So let's look then at how this happened in this particular period of time. We're told towards the end of that particular section that we're looking at that the angel took the censer and filled it from the fire of the altar and cast it into the earth, and there were voices and thunders and lightnings and an earthquake. Now each of these symbols is quite significant. Let's look at each of the four symbols that we've got here. Voices and thunders and lightnings and an earthquake. Let's take the voices first of all. The voice in this particular section is described as the voice of the Lamb, in response to the prayers of the saints, in which he is rendering recompense to his enemies. Now, Constantine died in the year AD 337, and the strife that ensued in relation to the succession to the throne constituted these voices which were being raised. Now, when Constantine died, it was divided up amongst his three sons. The empire was divided in three particular directions. On the advice of some church leaders, they were advised to wipe out the rest of the descendants of Constantine, so there shouldn't be any more contenders to the throne. Well, they wiped out most of them, with the exception of two. One of these was a person by the name of Julian. Anyway, these other people, they fought amongst themselves, as history is always wont to reveal to us, that when you seem to have a divided monarchy, they always fight amongst themselves, and in the end they usually wipe each other out. And this is what happened. To cut a long story short, you can read the long story in Eureka. These three men who had divided the kingdom up amongst themselves eventually all got wiped out. And what was left then was only this fellow by the name of Julian. Julian had been placed in charge of an army up in the area of Gaul. He'd had quite a bit of success, and the army had eventually convinced him that he should stand for emperor. And so he did, in fact, become the emperor. Now, this was some of the intrigue that was going on in the period of the voices. The thunders symbolised the internal wars that were going on, and the lightnings, the internal discord and revolution. But the earthquake came when Julian came to the throne. There are several earthquakes in the book of Revelation. There are four particular earthquakes. There are the three earthquakes that divide the seals from the trumpets and from the vials. But there is this other event which is styled an earthquake. So obviously this was a fairly important event if it is styled an earthquake. The earthquake here in this verse is representative of the temporary restoration of paganism as the religion of the state by Julian, who was known in history as Julian the Apostate. This particular fellow, when he came to the throne, he decided that he was going to restore paganism. And you see, Constantine had only just established Christianity. He'd only established it a few years earlier. Along comes Julian, and he decides that he is going to restore paganism. Now, this, of course, is a major revolution, or it would have been had the events continued on. But he only reigned for a year and 8 months, and he wasn't able to do a lot of damage in that time. But when I say damage, well, what he was trying to restore, of course, was, in fact, little worse than what was already there. Now, our note goes on to say that Julian was a pagan. He treated all religions alike, and he removed the disqualifications and the persecutions that the Catholics had laid upon so-called heretical sects. And these heretical sects included the true followers of Christ. He protected the Jewish people, not particularly because he liked Jews, but because they hated the Christians. And he restored the pagan priesthood. He effectively turned everything upside down. Hence, it was an earthquake. So we see then what we've got here in these early verses of Revelation chapter 8 is, first of all, a period of peace, of silence in the heavens, during the reign of Constantine. This gave a certain amount of political stability to the scene, during which time the saints, of course, were given the opportunity to plead for the divine intervention which they knew would come. And then with the death of Constantine, there was this voices, thunders, lightnings, and an earthquake. So we've set out here very briefly what the voices, the thunders, the lightnings, and the earthquake answer to. Once again, you can read this in more detail as far as the historical events are concerned in Eureka. It makes very interesting reading, but I don't intend to go into too much depth in the historical matters as far as our class is concerned. Now, if you'd like to come back then to the notes which we've got here, we can see the summary as far as the theme is concerned on the bottom of page 88. We quote Brother Roberts first of all. He says that at the end of the 15 years, judgments were casting their coming shadows over the scene. The church triumphant under Constantine became as great a persecutor of the true and faithful disciples of Christ as ever the pagan emperors had been. And God was about to bring a series of scourges on the persecuting church in retribution. They were scourges to come directly at the divine call. Therefore, seven angels are seen to receive seven trumpets, which they were successively to summon these judgments on the scene, with which they were to successively summon these judgments on the scene. Before they begin to sound, another angel comes to the altar with a golden censer, with which he offers incense with the prayers of all the saints. The golden altar is Christ. The angel with the censer is the representative of the saints in the attitude of prayer. There was special need for prayer at this time. The true saints were being oppressed and afflicted greatly by the dominant church, which could not tolerate their dissent from its diktat and their protest against its unchristian ways. Prayer to God was the only weapon of defence left them against their enemies. I have mentioned about the necessity for prayer today. Perhaps we think that there are other ways of defence against our enemies. We don't feel entirely helpless. We feel somewhat self-sufficient in this age. But in fact, the situation is no different. It only appears to be different. We are just as dependent, of course, upon the power of prayer today as these people ever were. It was more obvious to them than what it is to us, and perhaps for that reason, they rested more heavily on prayer than we do. Having offered the incense with the prayers of all the saints, the angel took the censer and filled it with fire off the altar and cast it unto the earth. And there were voices and thunderings and lightnings and an earthquake. The history of the 30 years succeeding the death of Constantine in AD 337 is the best illustration of the import of this symbolism. Faction and strife and bloodshed among his sons, and civil war consequent upon the revolt of a military officer, Magnentius, aiming at and for a time wearing the imperial purple, ended in the elevation of Julian, a votary of paganism, to the throne of the empire. This political earthquake was a terrible calamity to the Catholic Church, at whose instigation the persecutions were conducted, for which these were retributive public disasters. The elevation of Julian led to an attempt to restore paganism to the position it held before the victories of Constantine. This attempt, though not finally successful, was sufficiently formidable to subject the bishops and adherents of the Catholic Church to great tribulation. The voices and the lightnings and the thunder and the earthquake, having expended themselves in the accomplishment of their mission, the seven angels prepared themselves to sound. Let's just go back now and read slowly Revelation chapter 8 verses 1 to 5 and see if, in view of what we've said, we can now make some sense of this as we just read it through, perhaps interpolating and paraphrasing some things as we go. We're told in verse 1 that when he had opened the seventh seal, there was silence in the political ruling systems, the heaven, for between 14 and 15 years, around about half an hour in day years. And I saw the seven angels which stood before God, and to them were given seven trumpets. We'll describe in just a moment the significance of the trumpets. Now another angel other than these seven, I just see them standing there for the moment, but in the meantime, before they sound, another angel came and stood at the altar, having a golden censer, and there was given unto him much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense which came with the prayers of the saints ascended up before God out of the angel's hand, and the angel took the censer and filled it with fire of the altar and cast it into the earth, and there were voices and thunders and lightnings and an earthquake, answering to the turmoil which took place immediately after the death of Constantine, as his three sons fight amongst themselves, and finally another one, Julian the Apostate, comes to the throne and in the period of 1 year and 8 months, he tries to replace Christianity with paganism. But he didn't last for too long, and finally he was disposed of as well. And so the status quo was restored, and we're back with Catholicism. We're now going to have a look then at the way in which God is going to judge the Catholic system. This next period is known as the period of the seven trumpets. Just looking briefly at the transference we've got here, this is of course the fold out which you've got in your notes between pages 88 and 89. You can refer to it in either of the places. This presents to us a general outline of these seven trumpets. We've got the first six seals disappearing down here to what would be the left, if you like. We've got the seventh seal here, in which we're told in chapter 8 and verse 1, there was silence in the heaven about the space of half an hour, that is about 15 years, in the government of Imperial Rome under Constantine. We're going to come now then to the seven trumpets. Now, as far as the seven trumpets are concerned, we've got the first four trumpets, which Brother Thomas styles the four wind trumpets, answering to these four winds which were being restrained from chapter 7 verses 1 to 3, and then the last three trumpets, which are styled the woe trumpets, because trumpet number 5 is styled the first woe, trumpet number 6 the second woe, and the seventh trumpet is the third woe. So there are actually two divisions there. We're only looking at it very broadly at the moment. We'll of course look at it in much more detail. So why trumpets? Well, let's have a look at what we know about the subject of trumpets in the Bible, and why God chose the symbol of trumpets here to represent his judgments on Catholic Rome. Now, this particular note tells us that the trumpet was used as a means of summoning people together prior to an act of Yahweh. It is permissible for you to copy the note down while I look up the references. You needn't feel guilty about that, because you've probably got to write fairly fast to get all of this down. The trumpets were used as a means of summoning people together prior to an act of Yahweh. And the first reference which we've noted there is Joel chapter 2. And in Joel chapter 2 we've got two verses which confirm this for us. Verse 1 and verse 15. Now Joel chapter 2 and verse 1 says, "Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of Yahweh cometh, for it is nigh at hand." And similarly in verse 15, "Blow the trumpet in Zion, sanctify a fast, call a solemn assembly." I think both of those verses substantiate for us our definition up here, that the trumpet was used as a means of summoning people together prior to an act of Yahweh. We've got two or three other references there, we'll look them up as well. Amos chapter 3 and verse 6. "Shall a trumpet be blown in the city, and the people not be afraid? Shall there be evil in the city, and Yahweh hath not done it?" And you've got the parallelism of thoughts there. The trumpet being blown in the city, the evil being poured out by Yahweh. And so it refers to that act of Yahweh. Jeremiah chapter 4 verse 5 is another similar one. Jeremiah chapter 4 and verse 5. "Declare ye in Judah, and publish in Jerusalem, and say, Blow ye the trumpet in the land. Cry, gather together, and say, Assemble yourselves, and let us go into the defenced cities." So you've got the idea of summoning people together and a judgment being poured out. And finally, Isaiah chapter 58 and verse 1. Isaiah chapter 58 verse 1, cry aloud, spare not. Lift up thy voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression, and the house of Jacob their sins. And so here was to be a divine judgment which was to be poured out upon these people. And so these seven trumpets now represent the complete, if you like, judgments which God was going to pour out on Catholic Rome. What he was going to do was he was going to summon people together to pour out these particular judgments. He's going to summon in the first four trumpets the various nations out of Europe. You know, the Huns and the Vandals and the Visigoths and these other ones. And the trumpet is blowing and summoning them to come down and to judge Catholic Rome. And then finally in the woe trumpets he goes further afield and we find the Muslims, the Mohammedans and so forth also coming in to judge Catholic Rome. So the trumpet then represents this call to judgment. Now here's a more lengthy note which is going to summarise for us what I have said. I put this one up here because I think it expresses a little bit better than what I've got in the notes. When you're writing the notes and your theme is very much in your mind, you think that something sounds very simple, and when you come back several months later and read it again, you think, well, I don't think that sounds all that simple,